Good afternoon. My name is Connie, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the HUD Multifamily Policies and Radon Risk Reduction in the United States conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. If you should need assistance during the call, press star, then zero, and an operator will come back online to assist you. Thank you. I would now like to turn the call over to your host, Ms. Meg Walker. Please go ahead.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the HUD Multifamily Policies and Radon Reduction Risk in the United States webinar. My name is Meg Walker, and I'm going to give you a brief introduction to using the webinar controls. In the upper right-hand side of your screen, you will see the webinar console. It looks like this. Use the buttons on the console sidebar that look like fast forward and rewind buttons to maximize and minimize the console. Use the buttons by pressing the button with the square inside, you can also minimize and maximize the webinar presentation on your computer screen. At the bottom of the minimized console, you will notice the questions feature. Use this to type in any questions you may have during the presentation. Here. You can minimize and maximize the questions pane by pressing the plus or minus sign next to it. Here. And you can pop out of the console into its own pane by pressing the triangular button, which is here. As you heard earlier, because of the large number of participants, we have muted all attendee lines to control the amount of background noise. If you have a question or a problem during the webinar, please use the question pane to communicate with us, and the questions will be answered verbally at the end. Finally, you may notice a mouse moving during the webinar. We apologize if this is distracting, and we will do our best to minimize it. I'm now going to hand over to Peter Hendricht, the Executive Director of the American Association of Radon Scientists and Technologists. Peter, please take it away.
Thank you, Meg. Welcome, everyone. This is the second of two webinars that we're having regarding HUD multifamily mortgage radon policies and the implementation of these policies, which took effect on June 4th. Today, we'll be giving an overview on the policy itself. We'll be citing some basic risk citations and goals and policies of the federal government as regards radon risk reduction. We'll be giving an overview of the radon certification and licensing infrastructure in the United States and the organizations, both public and private, that are involved with that. An overview of radon standards and multifamily standards in particular for measurement and the mitigation or fixing of multifamily buildings. We'll be giving an overview of the regulated and non-regulated states and their activities regarding policies, regulations, and radon risk reduction, and an overview of qualified application of radon standards, particularly for mitigation, and how a multifamily building differs from a single-family building and why this is important. At the very end, we'll be allowing for questions and answers. I see some questions right now, however, regarding audio. Audio does have to be dialed in, and I'll respond in writing to that to everyone so that they know they have to use the dial-in number. So again, the questions and the answers we'll get to at the very end of the presentation. Presentations today will be done by three individuals, Hillary Atkin, who's the environmental specialist for the HUD Office of Housing headquarters in Washington, D.C. Sean Price is the president of the American Association of Radon Scientists and Technologists, and Kyle Holman, who is an ARSC board member and a mitigator with field experience in working with large and multifamily buildings. So I would like to turn this over to Hillary Atkin, who is the environmental specialist at the HUD Office of Housing in Washington. Hillary?
Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for calling in to be part of this discussion of HUD's requirements and expectations under our new radon policy. What I'm going to try to do today is give you a good overview of what the policy is and what our staff will be looking for when documentation to comply with the policy is submitted. And I'm glad we're having this discussion early on. Please feel free to ask any questions that you have. It'd be best to get as many questions and answers out there as early as we can. If we could move to the next slide, please. And actually the next one after that. Okay, so we'll start with a brief overview here. Radon report is the form of the documentation that will be needed under this policy. It's required for all MAP and TAP applications. There are exceptions, which we, of course, will discuss later on. The radon report must be included in the pre-application or application, depending which path the project is taking, and will be included as an addendum to the environmental report. The content of the radon report should have the results of testing, any mitigation details, including timing, and must be amended to include any post-application testing or mitigation. So as you can see from these requirements, this is similar to what we do with with remediation based on the Phase 1 ESA, and basically requires that all testing and plans be submitted upfront with the application, and if any actual remediation or follow-up testing is required and must necessarily take place after application, that would be appended to the radon report, or the radon report would be amended to take that into account. Okay, next slide, please. Continuing with a few more details on the report must be prepared by a radon professional. And this boils down to mean that the radon professional must supervise all testing and mitigation. How we are defining a radon professional for this policy is someone who has certification from the American Association of Radon Scientists and Technologists National Radon Proficiency Program, or through the National Radon Safety Board, and any required licensing or certification from the state that the project is occurring in. Next slide, please. Now to get into the exceptions, everyone's favorite topic. Generally, there is an exception that could apply to any project, and that basically is along the lines of a valid justification logic. This would have to be determined by the radon professional, and the radon professional would basically make a determination that this site cannot have a radon issue for whatever reason and thus should not require a radon report. One example of such justification would be a building where the bottom floor is an open-air garage. I hope that's a good enough example to explain that. If you have any questions, feel free to ask. Our second exception has to do specifically with 223F transactions. If a 223F project is in a low-risk area according to the EPA map, we ask that you check available local maps and data to confirm that low risk, and if you can do so, no testing would be required. Now, we have had a few questions come up based on this exception. One has to do with, in the event that a local map or data is not available, is the EPA map alone enough justification that testing would not be required? The answer is yes. EPA map is okay if you cannot, if the local map or data is not available, or just not readily available. A local map or local data would be okay as long as it's government sponsored. Also, readily available basically means something that you can get off of the internet, but it can also mean that it's something that you get from a local government agency as long as it's not too difficult to get a hold of. Our final exception is for 223A7 transactions. No radon report is required for those transactions. Now, where a radon report is not required under these three exceptions, we do still encourage testing. And if you should choose to do testing and mitigation based on that testing, you must follow the various requirements that are outlined in the radon notice. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, so I've entitled this slide Radon Report Details to Include, and the reason I've done so is because on the presentation that we gave to HUD staff, I called it Radon Report, What to Look For. So these are the things that we are giving direction to our staff to look for within the report so that they have a good idea of whether it is valid and meets our requirements. Regarding the testing requirement, make sure that the document references the standard that is required. The standard that we require, of course, is the ANSI RMAF 2010 or 2012 testing standard. We also have directed our staff to make sure that a radon professional supervised the testing. And what I suggested they could look for that is a statement that a radon professional supervised, had the proper certifications, and prepared the report. And also the certifications for that radon professional should be included in the report. Make sure that at least 25% of randomly selected ground floor units were tested. There should be a statement to that effect within the report. And make sure that mitigation is performed and required if any of the testing results are above 4 picocuries per liter. And I just want to repeat that that's for any results. Also, to check and make sure that resident notification occurs, whether it's an existing project or a new construction project. And that has to do with testing and mitigation. Okay, next slide, please. More details for people to include in these reports. For the mitigation requirements, we have two standards that are required within the radon policy. The first is ASTM E2121-11, which is for existing structures. ARST also has a provisional multifamily mitigation standard that is out there and that is fine to use. We do want to make sure that E2121-11 is at least met while following those ARST standards that are in the multifamily standard. And the reason we ask that both be referenced if both are used is one, because the policy requires E2121, also because our standard is currently provisional, and once it becomes a final standard, HUD will be reviewing it for potential inclusion within the policy. And when we do that, we would modify the policy. The other standard that we reference and will be looking for in the report is ASTM E1465-08, which is for new construction. The entire building needs to be mitigated under this policy. That's what the policy is based on and why it allows 25% testing, which is not in line with the ARST 100% testing requirement within the ARST standard. With mitigation, as with testing, it needs to look for resident notification and for post-mitigation testing. Finally, at the end, after testing and mitigation is done, staff will check to make sure that a certification of completion has been appended to the radon report. Okay, next slide, please. So now we're just going to go briefly through some of the requirements that are laid out within our standard and within the different standards that we are utilizing. So you have an idea of what the radon report will look like for different types of transactions. Okay, so for 223F transactions, HUD has a lot of different timing requirements with their various transactions and applications, and the radon report is no exception. Testing must have been done within a year of application submission. Unless they qualify for an exemption from testing under the exceptions we discussed previously, or if they decide to just proceed directly to mitigation instead of doing testing. Mitigation for 223F transactions will be in line with ASTM E2121-11 and may also be in line with the ARS multifamily standard. And mitigation must be completed as quickly as practicable, but no later than 12 months after initial endorsement or initial closing, depending on which term you like to use. Next slide, please. For sub-rehab and conversions, testing is required in all radon risk zones. Prior to application, if the testing is done prior to application, it must be performed no earlier than 1 year prior. If the testing must be performed post-application because it was not feasible because of the changes to the building envelope, that is acceptable and should proceed directly to mitigation. Testing after construction must take place after and final endorsement, or if testing must take place after final endorsement, it will result in retrofit mitigation if the results are above the threshold, which is 4 picocuries per liter. And like 223F transactions, mitigation must be in line with ASTM E2121-11 and may also be in line with the ARS multifamily standard. Next slide, please. For new construction, all new construction must be built with radon-resistant construction. There's a different types of radon-resistant construction are required based on what risk zone that proposed site is within. So for new construction in the zone 1, it must be built with passive radon-resistant construction according to ASTM E1465-08. For new construction in zones 2 and 3, it must meet the gas permeable layer, ground cover, and foundation wall requirements of ASTM E1465-08. Post-construction testing is required, and if it results, if the results are above the threshold, the radon-resistant construction, which is already done, must be stepped up to meet higher standards. So if that is within a Zone 1 site, active system must be installed. If it's within a Zone 2 or 3 site, passive system must be installed. As we alluded to earlier, residents must be informed of all radon testing and mitigation that took place. And mitigation must be completed by final endorsement or final closing, depending on which term you prefer. So that is my overview of HUD's policy. If you have any questions regarding anything that I said, make sure to write them down and save them up, and we will address them later. Thank you. And now I'd like to introduce Sean Price, who is the president of ARST.
Thank you, Hillary. Next slide. What I want to do is go over some radon basics for a moment. A lot of us on the webinar today that may be in the radon industry or with the state radon programs may be very familiar with this. We have invited some audiences that aren't spending the day in and day out in the radon world, so for their benefit, I'm going to go over a little bit of an introduction. EPA estimates that we have about 157,000 lung cancer deaths nationally. This was back in 1995. Of those, about 13% were radon-related. There is a lot of research. There's a lot of data that goes out there. It is a known cancer-causing agent that really isn't disputable in the medical or the scientific world. The last major report that addressed the radon risks that came out of the National Academy of Science was done in 2003. That was called the BEER-6 report. That pretty much also reemphasized the fact that, 21,000 Americans are estimated to be losing their lives from radon-induced lung cancer every year. If we did a population and a housing adjustment in 2013, we're probably closer to 25,000 deaths per year. So the problem is getting worse. It's not getting better, which reinforces the importance of this policy and how we can use it to reduce unnecessary lives lost. Next slide, please. We Within the public health network, we have EPA, the National Academy of Sciences, the Surgeon General. Everybody agrees that this is the second leading cause of lung cancer in America. However, it's the number one cause of cancer in non-smokers. And if we were to stack radon up on the radon-induced lung cancer on the entire cancer spectrum, it stands number seven by itself, and that is not inclusive of only lung cancer. That's all cancers. So it's a very significant health risk. The EPA action level is 4 picocuries per liter, and there are some references that you'll see in some publications and on the Internet about the World Health Organization, or WHO. They have a reference level of 2.7 picocuries per liter. Next slide. The major U.S. policy in the United States was created in 1988 with the passage of the Indoor Radon Abatement Act. The Indoor Radon Abatement Act is what gave EPA the authority to handle the radon programs in the United States. It also was the spearhead to set the action level to create proficiency and certification programs, to create the training centers for radon practitioners, and also the state indoor radon grants. And the main goal of the Indoor Radon Abatement Act is very clear. It is to bring the indoor radon levels of the building to that of equal of outdoor radon levels. And that's a very difficult to reach goal, but the point that it emphasizes is there is no safe level of radon. And the only way to completely reduce the risks of radon-induced lung cancer is to reduce the exposure to radon gas. Next slide. Okay, the 1988 Indoor Radon Abatement Act set forward a lot of the groundwork that has grown into our current radon industry and our radon profession. The standards, the protocols that EPA originally put together was implemented because of IRA, and the Stewart-McKinney Amendments was the piece that went in and touched on multifamily housing. And there was work done years ago between EPA and HUD that developed some initial procedures for properly testing multifamily buildings. They were never implemented. However, this was the document that became the starting point for the current ARST-ANSI measurement standard for multifamily buildings. And then the most recent development, which again has implications here with the new HUD policy, is the 2011 Federal Radon Action Plan that EPA has used to engage many more of the federal agencies to look at ways of addressing radon risks and to try to reduce those risks. Next slide. Underneath EPA, we've got a network of different types of organizations and entities that are also involved in the radon program. Some are governmental, some are private. There are some nonprofits as well, of different varieties of nonprofits, I should say. For the radon practitioners, we have the American Association of Radon Scientists and Technologists. The state radon programs are also involved through an organization called the Conference of Radiation Control Program Directors, and that is called CRCPD is the acronym, and similar to ARST, that is an organization representing not just radon people, but radiation officers and people like that as well. There are two private radon certification programs. We've got the National Radon Proficiency Program and the National Radon Safety Board. Next slide. K Okay, the history on radon certification at the national level was started back in the EPA back in actually 1986. They created a radon listing program for analytical laboratories, and they operated that program from 1986. They added certification for testers and mitigators in the late 80s, early 90s. And due to federal budget constraints, the program was privatized in 1998. And out of that, again, two programs were born, the two that I mentioned previously, the National Radon Proficiency Program, known for a good while as the NEHA NRPP, now known as the ARST NRPP, and the National Radon Safety Board. The EPA's radon laboratory out in Las Vegas, Nevada, is involved as well. They're more of a a resource, a technical resource for radon chambers and radon device approval. They are our national standard, you might as well say, they have the ruler that says what is for picocuries. So we have our laboratories that calibrate to calibration chambers. Those calibration chambers keep reference over to EPA, so everybody sees the same markings on the yardstick, if you will. Devices are approved for use by the two certification programs, and the Las Vegas lab is used as one of the exposure resources to make sure that those controlled exposures are documented and are defensible. And then within the testing and mitigation credentialing under the licensing and certifications, there's typically entry-level exams, coursework, there's continuing education on an ongoing basis, device calibration, performance testing for those that provide analytical services like laboratories or folks with portable equipment, and quality control. Okay, next slide. Within the standards and the protocol world, most of the work to date over the last several years have been working on single-family homes. So under the single-family testing and mitigation standards, of course, Hillary has made mention of ASTM E2121, which is the mitigation standard. ARS Consortium on National Radon Standards also has done some mitigation standard work, some testing, some radon-resistant new construction, and we are still utilizing some of the original EPA protocols for measurement in homes that were from 1992-1993. There are a couple of the different radon-resistant new construction standards. We've got, of course, ASTM 1465, which was already mentioned, and then we have the more recent publication, the ARST, what we call RRNC 2.0, which was written in code-ready language. Both ARST and ASTM are ANSI-accredited standard writing organizations, and ANSI is the American National Standards Institute, which is the watchdog, if you will, on all of the consensus-based standard work in the United States. Okay, next slide. Okay, when we take the radon standards and we move into the multifamily housing world, ASTM E2121 still has a lot of very helpful, useful parts that are applicable to multifamily homes to some degree. Also, ASTM's E1465 has some implications, of course, on both single-family and multifamily housing. We've got the ARST-ANSI multifamily testing standard, and then, of course, which was already mentioned just briefly, the provisional radon mitigation standard for multifamily buildings, and I'll elaborate that on just a bit in a moment. Next slide. Okay, one of the most frequent questions we've had is, wait a minute, what's the difference in the 25% testing rate versus 100%? Obviously, the standard calls for testing 100% of the ground floor units. Also, it says 10% on each upper floor, and the reason is radon doesn't always start at the bottom, and it doesn't always stay at the bottom. So there are some clear documented reasons that sometimes we need to find pathways or building material problems that may be all on the upper floor. So the standard goes a bit beyond what the HUD policy is, that's put together by panels of experts that have a lot of multifamily building experience. The HUD policy, as we mentioned, says a minimum of 25% ground floor units tested, but it doesn't say a maximum of 25%. So I just want to make that clear. It doesn't say you can only test 25%, but when they're checking the application for the loan, they're going to make sure that at least 25% was tested. There are people that say random testing is a viable option. I know that in some worlds, like in asbestos and lead, you can do some random testing when the whole building was painted with the same, out of the same buckets of paint, the same floor tile. That might be valid, but what we know in the radon world is this invisible pressure-driven gas doesn't follow the rules of any of the other environmental problems. And to do proper modeling of a random sampling test with radon to reach about a 95% degree of confidence, you're going to have to require 80% of the ground floor units would be tested. So if you're going to do 80, you might as well do 100. That's kind of the moral of the story for me anyway. Next slide. Okay, if we wanted to compare a little bit about the single family versus the multifamily mitigation standard, ASTM E2121 is the workhorse. That has a lot of very basic elements in radon mitigation system design. It will fall short in some of the more complicated structures, but the fact that it is, telling us the gauge of the pipe to use, how to properly, install the system, fastening the pipe to the building, where to exhaust, all of those basics are solid in E2121. So it is a starting point, and by doing the basics that you're following within E2121, the system will be a good viable system. But the more complex systems, the more complex jobs may require a little bit more, which is where the multifamily mitigation standard comes in. So next slide, please. The ANSI standard is in provisional phase right now. What that means is it has been released in an early form. However, it is continuing to be developed and worked on. It has just come out of a six-week public comment period, and it will be reviewed, revised, and if there were substantive changes during that six-week period, it will be re-released for an additional six-week comment period. So folks out there in the radon testing and mitigation world that want to comment, look in the next few weeks for announcements regarding whether or not the provisional standard will be going back out for another public review process. The multifamily standard goes a little deeper than ASTM E2121. It has communication plans that aren't necessarily addressed in E2121. How to deal with adjoining dwellings, again, something more dynamic in multifamily that we don't run across every day in the single family world. What's going on in the family across the hall, across the wall? The exhaust points and citizen safety. Multifamily projects and areas have places where there's more traffic, more foot traffic, a lot more occupants around the property. The big thing for me is long-term risk management plans and things like that. So it's more of just not how to glue pipe, but it's properly planning out a multifamily testing strategy. So it doesn't necessarily disagree with E2121, but what it does is it takes where E2121 left off and it elaborates much, much deeper. Next slide, please. And if we look at the state radon programs, we have out of the 50 states, not all states have current programs. So, you know, 35 and 15, you know, it does round out to 50. But we do know of a couple that have been eliminated at least temporarily due to budget constraints. But if we were to break down the programs before some of them were closed, we have 35 that we call voluntary states, meaning that they don't have any licensing or credentialing laws on the books that force requirements on the radon professionals. And in those states, they usually rely on the private certification programs to help them to deem the lists of who is properly trained and who can properly test and install mitigation systems. They don't have regulatory authority or rulemaking authority, and so they are really needing sometimes these consensus-based standards because they don't have a process to put these out themselves. The remainder of the states, which is of course less than half of the remaining state, or less than half of the remaining states, are regulated, and they either have their own licensing program or have a requirement that you have to go get one of the national certifications before you can do business. They do have regulatory authority, and they can put in to affect their own protocols, their own policies. They can also have the authority to require use of one of the consensus-based standards. Next slide, please. And for the benefit of some of those that may not be in the radon world day in and day out, we do have two types of the regulated programs. The list of states on the left have more formal programs where they do their own credentialing. Some have their own exams. Some have their own training requirements. And then out of the states on the right, there is more of a use of the national programs or the requirements that the national programs use to come back and obtain approval from the state to do business. Next slide. To reiterate, you know, some of the way that these states work, in the non-regulated, non-licensed states, the marketplace relies on the private credentialing. And again, NRPP and NRSB are the two programs that were deemed equal or at least up to par with the former EPA radon proficiency programs. But it's not a requirement that people in these non-regulated states have to come through them, come through the programs. So there are people that are legally operating radon testing and mitigation businesses out there that by nature they're allowed to do so, but there are those that have never been properly trained or never have been properly tested on the exams. So we have to make sure that we get the word out that there is legitimate credentials really are required to make sure that the practitioners are able to do the work needing to be done. So we recommend using experienced, properly insured, properly bonded vendors, and most importantly, conforming to all of the recognized standards. Next slide. So if I were to put out, you know, a list of what one would look for in a current vendor, of course, state licensed is a requirement in those states that are, you know, that were on our regulatory list. But according to the HUD policy, In addition to that, they have to be nationally certified by NRPP or NRSB. Some states have special approvals on top of the normal license. This is not meant to be a complete list, but Illinois and Ohio are two where there are additional hoops to jump through after your normal license if you want to do multifamily work. So check with your state to make sure that you understand the requirements before before you either hire practitioners or that you bid on jobs that you may not quite have met the requirements. Experience level, maybe a recommendation of 5 years, depending on somebody's background. Somebody with a lot of building science knowledge may not have had to be in the radon field for 5 years, but we need to look at bringing, making sure that people that are going to be doing the work are properly able to do that. So, design and building experiences. There are some other types of projects like school testing, mitigation, Department of Defense housing that people have on their resumes. And again, the properly insured and the knowledge of the standards. Next slide. For NRPP, we are adding some certificates this fall. Our implementation goal is in October 2013 that we have two additional multifamily certifications that we are working on. They're going to be add-on to the basic residential measurement and residential mitigation credentials, so people can add them on. We're looking at possibly experience requirements. Some of these we're still looking at what the requirements are going to be. We definitely know that there's going to be successful completion of a special multifamily coursework and an exam. We may ask for capabilities of properly designing systems, advanced diagnostics for the mitigation crowd, and there will be separate and defined listings for this this additional credential. Next slide. Okay, I'm going to turn this over to Kyle. He's going to go into a couple of case studies here, or a few case studies, and helps to bring the light on how all of these policies are going to be affecting us in the real world. Kyle.
Thanks, Sean. As Sean said, I was asked to join in today to provide the, I guess for lack of a better term, the boots on the ground perspective. I work out of Louisville, Kentucky with an environmental contracting firm, and we have experience with hundreds of multifamily testing and mitigation projects. I was asked to pull some of the most common scenarios that we think are going to occur as you're working in the field, and I've come up with four scenarios that would by far be what we have seen in the past. So I'll go ahead and jump in with the next slide. So by far the most common scenario that we see, or the discussion that comes up in the field, is does a radon problem exist within a building? And the answer to that really depends on what's tested. So if you take a step back and you look at a traditional building that might be out there, for example, this building where you have a duplex unit on an end on a separate foundation with a breezeway. Maybe it's two stories. You have a breezeway with an upper and lower story walkway. You can have a quadplex in the middle on a separate foundation. This quadplex, quite frankly, could be even further divided with enhanced footers, other things that would make communication or creating vacuum, which is how we fix radon problems, under the building a little more difficult to achieve. And then you'd have another breezeway with a third foundation area. So if you follow strictly the multifamily, the minimum policy as Hillary had laid out, let's say that we tested 25% of the units in this building. So we picked unit 5, unit 3. Unit 5 on foundation came back at 3.1 picocuries, that's less than the action level. On Foundation 2, we had Unit 3 tested at 1.8, and that's less than 4.0 as well. So the question is, does a radon problem exist in the building? And in this instance, which is going to be a pretty common scenario, the answer is we don't know. We didn't do enough testing. We simply did not test Foundation 3. So we don't know if there was a preferential pathway that could have been present on that foundation that maybe didn't show up on the other two foundations. We also don't know if these other two foundations could have had thick and footers or other obstructions where a problem may have existed. So our recommendation here is when you have multiple foundation areas, we would apply a minimum of 25% of the units located on each foundation area. So in this case, we would have gone ahead and bumped up to a total of 3 tests, minimum of 25 on each separate foundation area. And, of course, the best practice would be to require 100% of all ground floor units in your testing plan. For those lenders in the audience that have write both HUD and as well as Fannie Freddie, this is going to be a variation from what you're used to. You're used to one test per building or 10% of all units. And again, just to reiterate, the multifamily HUD policy is a minimum of 25% of units being tested. So that's going to be a little different than what you may be used to with the Fannie Freddie guidelines. Next slide, please. So if we do, in fact, test 100% of the units, then the question comes back, if a problem is identified, what are we actually fixing? So in this example, we have a standard 12 ground floor unit building. We tested 100% of the units. 3 of the units, unit 4, unit 5, and unit 11, actually attested above the action level. So in this case, the question becomes, well, which unit is actually required for mitigation? And the answer to that is when a single unit is identified in the building, the approach here is to holistically treat the building, not just a specific unit. Again, I use this scenario because we all have a lot of experience with Fannie Freddie guidelines, and there are some interpretation of that guideline out there that would suggest that just simply treating a unit would be sufficient. And within the HUD policy, the policy is, in fact, to treat the building as a whole, not the unit. From a practical standpoint, when you start changing or you take an approach of just trying to correct a single unit, you start to change, or you have the potential to change the pressure the differential or the variations in the building. And you can actually have the unintended consequence of creating a problem in another area of the building where a problem didn't exist beforehand, or making a problem worse in the other areas of the building that would be untreated. So again, the HUD policy is when a single unit or a group of units within the building are elevated above the action level, that the building itself is treated as opposed to an individual unit. Next slide. Once a problem has been identified and mitigation has taken place, the thing that we need to keep in mind is, unlike some remediation type of systems where maybe they're on site for a period of months or years until the problem goes away, with radon being naturally occurring, these are really permanent structures or permanent additions to the building structure, and they do have mechanical components. Which means that we are going to have ongoing operation and maintenance. In my opinion, this is one of the areas that's most frequently overlooked in the multifamily housing that we are involved in, and that is what ongoing operation and maintenance items are required. What should I be doing as a property manager, as a lender? What should the requirement be to make sure that these systems actually continue to do the job that they're designed to do? So in this case, if we did successfully mitigate a building, Once the final clearance documentation has been issued to the client, what else should be in place? The ARS multifamily mitigation standard requires a written long-term risk management plan. And at minimum, the plan should include or must include an ongoing inspection and maintenance schedule. Now, that might be a blend of on-site supervision from on-site maintenance that works hand-in-hand with the mitigation contractor to design that program. These systems have monitors. Monitors should be checked frequently to make sure the system is continuing to function correctly. Maybe an annual inspection is added into that where the contractor is back on site just making sure that some of the more advanced things are being handled. And then the building should be retested one time every 2 years. As the geology changes, the pathway potential could change, and that could also change the way that these systems function. Perfect example, I mentioned we work out of Louisville, Kentucky. We do a lot of work down around the Fort Knox area, and a perfect example of geology changing is fixing a building only to find out that after they've bombed the artillery range next to the building, all of the pathways close in one area and open in another area can become a frustrating, unique challenge in making sure that you maintain the consistency of the mitigation effort. So being back in there on a frequent basis, again, recommendation is one time every 2 years to retest, and then again, making sure that the monitoring, making sure that the equipment, the seals are maintained, the blowers are maintained, that's something that should be done at minimum on an annual basis. Next slide, please. And in wrapping up, some other policy considerations that you may choose to consider, and some of these are included in the multifamily mitigation standard, the ARS-ANSI standard version of it. In some instances, alternative mitigation techniques may be required. Recovery ventilation, the old adage, the solution to pollution is solution. That's another option in correcting some radon problems. So instead of depressurization, we might choose building pressurization in some larger structures. Recovery ventilation, where we're pulling in fresh air into the building. Larger structures, multifamily structures that have HVAC systems that have fresh air makeup. Oftentimes, you can correct radon mitigate or radon issues through modification of the fresh air on the HVAC system. So those and some of the larger projects are certainly going to come into play. As I mentioned, HVAC influence must be taken into consideration. Example would be a school system. It's oftentimes that you'll go into a school and you find out that the fresh air makeup is set during the day when folks are in school. At that time, you have a lot of fresh air coming in. Radon's not a problem. And of an evening, you'll see on a monitor where the radon goes up because you've taken the dilution factor away. In some of your multifamily buildings, you're going to have the same scenarios arise when you have complex structures with multi-zone HVAC systems. As Sean had mentioned before, you get into other areas of the country and different challenges arise. For example, you go down into Florida. I know that some time ago there were some articles out where building emanation in the Florida area, radon was actually emanating out of the concrete. Well, that was on upper levels of some of the high-rise buildings that were tested. So the testing policy is set that way for a reason, and that is to make sure that we're sampling some of the upper areas of these buildings to rule out the potential for things like emanation. Radon in water, when you get into the northeastern country, radon water is a very real issue. I don't know the exact number, but numerous in excess of probably 10% or more of all the mitigation that takes place in the northeastern part of the country can be traced back to radon in water. A few years ago, we had granite countertops, and do granite countertops emanate radon? And the answer is maybe, possibly. The only way to know is to test and rule that out in your actual sampling plant. So those are some of the other challenges that may arise from time to time, dealing with a local contractor who has experience in that specific region of the country is going to be helped in walking through those hurdles. The last thing is, and this is more to the lender side, is I would strongly recommend that you consider requiring a non-interference agreement. And this just came up recently, right as we were doing the HUD presentation a few weeks ago with field personnel. We had a project here. We arrived at the project, and the property manager said, we're ready for you. We've instructed all of our residents to keep their doors and windows open, and they've been open for a couple days. Well, obviously, that kind of goes against the policy. We don't want to pollute these areas. We test under closed building conditions. And taking that a little further, the maintenance personnel said, yes, that's what we were advised. That was later confirmed by an unsurly older gentleman who was upset that we were now telling him that he needed to close everything up and wait another day for us to come back in, because he had been advised in his communication to keep his windows and his doors open. So one of those things that you might want to consider having in the file is just a document that clearly outlines to the property manager or the personnel that's going to be responsible for overseeing the test that here's what needs to be maintained so that nothing, in fact, goes wrong with that testing event itself. Those are some of the things for you to think about as you move forward and the policy is implemented. What I'm going to do now is turn it back over to Peter Hendrick, and I think we'll go through some questions and answers. Peter?
Thank you, Kyle. First, I want to thank all of the presenters today and just point out that we've posted on the website a number of links to various resources concerning radon, the EPA government radon website, the ARS website, the Conference of Radiation Control Program Directors website, which has very detailed references for state radon programs and their own radon program, and the two certification organizations, the National Radon Proficiency Program and the National Radon Safety Board, both maintain websites. One of the questions that came in was, you know, where can we find listings of professionals who are qualified to do this work? And the simple answer is that the states that are licensed, that have licensing programs, maintain licensing lists on their states, and the NRPP and NRSB websites provide the certified professionals by category, mitigation, and measurement. And proposition that you in the licensed states, they have to be licensed and certified. There will be slides and audio available on the ARS website, www.ars.org. And in fact, there is a earlier slideshow and audio already posted on that website, along with a generic frequently asked questions. And later this evening, we will upload and update two additional FAQ packages for property managers and for HUD lenders that are very specific in terms of answering some of the more generic and specific questions for those categories. Right now we have some questions that we're going to try to get to in the time that we have left, and I'll be reading the questions and directing them to our panel. If we do not get to your question or overlook it, we have had quite a few come in, We will be taking each question and eventually posting it on the website, and we will be sending a reference link to everyone who received a notice on this about this call today so that they can find the questions and answers that you had. One of the first questions comes from the professional sector. Can you address details about what the 223A and F transactions are and what the differences are between them? Fairly detailed question, and I think, Hillary, you might be best able to answer that, hopefully.
Sure, yeah, I can answer that. So asking about what 223A7 and 223F mean. A 223A7 transaction is a refinance of a HUD insured loan. So basically what that means is there's the borrower is looking to refinance and the loan is already within HUD's portfolio. A 223F transaction is also a refinance, however, it is not already within HUD's portfolio. And that is basically the difference between the two. So they're more financial transactions as opposed to a transaction that would involve extensive repairs or rehabilitation.
Great, good. So let's see. We have two somewhat related questions, and I'm going to bundle them together. One is with respect to exceptions. Is the environmental professional conducting the Phase 1 environmental assessment qualified to make the determination that no testing is required based on a review of the EPA map? And the second question came from another individual. Does a local radon risk map supersede or trump the EPA map mapping? And I don't know if we're able, I'm going to throw that out to the entire panel, but Hillary, I think the first one, particularly the concerning the Phase 1 environmental professional, are they the ones who make the decision about the exception?
Yeah, those are both great questions. So the first question having to do with who can, I think the question is, who can make that special exception for 223F projects having to do with which EPA map zone that they are in, which is confirmed by local data or map. And we actually set that exception up so it does not have to be the radon professional making that determination, since it's just based on looking at one or two maps. It could be the lender. It could be the preparer of the Phase 1 ESA.
Okay, great. And, you know, as far as I know, we're using the EPA map at this time and not local mapping as the reference point?
Well, so getting to the second question, the idea is that if you have a local data or map that is available that and that shows that the data, the additional testing that was done at that local level indicates a higher radon level than the EPA map, you would use that local map. So that local map is supposed to be more specific, and it is supposed to trump the EPA map, yes.
Okay. All right. So let's see. If we have elevated results in 25% of the units tested, what is HUD's policy for a recommendation? And shouldn't there are two questions to this, and shouldn't the rest of the ground floor units be tested prior to determining the mitigation process or the remedy?
Okay, that's another good question. So basically, the way that the policy works is that at least 25% of units have to be tested, and mitigation can be designed based on that testing. So if the lender gets those results back and there are some elevated results and they're trying to figure out whether they want to do confirmation testing, mitigation, or just go with 100% testing to get the full view of what's going on at the site, those are decisions that they can make. But if they do anything less than 100% testing, mitigation is based on the entire building. So I think that gets to what that question is getting to.
And
we don't make any, so I guess I should say HUD doesn't make any specific recommendations of what you should do once you get your testing results for 25%, except that if you have any elevated results, you do have to mitigate based on the entire building. And any other retesting or confirmation testing would be in accordance with the ARS testing standard.
Okay, now here's a question that may pertain to HUD or maybe some of the other panel will want to jump in, but is there a height limit on the testing requirement in terms of number of stories, five stories versus 20 stories, et cetera? I don't think we've had that one before. any thought on that in terms of how the RSDNC standard is, Kyle or Scott?
Yeah, I'll take that one, Peter. The way that the RSDNC standard is written is that it's 100% of the units with ground contact. So that would be, you know, on the first floor, basement dwellings, things like that. On top of that, you're going to go 10% of the units on each floor of the building. And it doesn't say if it's a 20-floor building to only test the first, say, three floors. So the premise there is that in a multi-story building, according to the ARST-ANSI standard, not only are you going to saturate the entire ground floor, making sure all of the units, but you're going to test staggered units all the way up to the top at a rate of one for every 10. 10% or one per floor. If maybe there's eight units per floor, five units per floor, one unit per floor. But what you don't want to do is test all of the southeast corner units all the way up. We're trying to stagger the placement so that we can look at mechanical chases. We can look at elevator shafts, stairwells, or the radon emanation out of the building material scenarios, which we see a lot of in the southeast. So the ARST-ANSI standard does not say that, you know, in a 20-floor building you can stop after three floors.
And I think you've answered one of the other related questions from Robert. Does HUD require 10% testing of upper floors? And you've actually gone into some detail on the fact that when you're doing that minimum of one per floor, that you don't do it in a stacked manner. You spread them out.
Well, and just to clarify, the HUD policy requires 25%, at least 25% of ground contact units.
Okay.
So that is the policy. That is with the caveat that if you choose to go with that, you do have to do mitigation based on the building.
Okay, so now we have, does post-application testing information in phase one apply to new construction?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Okay. Does post-application testing information in the phase one apply to new construction?
Okay, so that's a little bit of a confusing question. The phase one isn't really involved with this standard. Anything that you'd be putting together involving radon would be in a radon report that's appended to other reports that you would submit. So taking that out of the question, I think what the question was is, would there be post-mitigation, post-radon-resistant construction testing? And the answer is yes. And to assure that the mitigation was effective, and that is part of what is stated in the HUD radon policy and also what is stated within the mitigation standards that we are utilizing for the policy. Does that seem to answer that question?
I think so. John?
Yeah, I think so.
Does HUD have a relocation plan requirement for units above a certain threshold?
I'm not sure what that question means.
Yeah, we'll have to research that. And I think what they what they're indicating is there a limit on when you tell people to move out. And I think we will have to seek guidance from EPA on health risk on that one. Do these rules apply to expansion of existing MAP and TAP properties in adding buildings, expanding other required multifamily properties? Do these rules apply to the expansion of existing MAP and TAP properties, that is, adding buildings?
Okay, so I think what the question is getting at is if there's an existing building and there's some sort of substantial rehabilitation going on, would this apply? The answer to that is yes. There is actually a specific section of the radon policy that discusses substantial rehabilitation.
Okay. Is there a difference between a mitigation installer for multifamily buildings and one who designs the system, the engineer, the contractor? That may be a more generic question to someone like Kyle, and maybe the expertise required in multifamily approaches. Do you want me to readdress the question, Kyle?
Sure.
Is there a difference between a mitigation installer for multifamily buildings and one who designs the system, an engineer or architect?
Yeah, oftentimes you'll have people within the same office that have expertise in one area or another. So part of any good mitigation plan is going to require upfront communication testing. And by communication testing, simply will the system that's designed, or in theory, will the system that's designed actually create the vacuum or induce the vacuum under the slab to correct the problem? So you can get at that within the organization. Sometimes in superstructures, you may have engineering firms involved, especially on the new construction site where you're laying out passive ventilation, how large of a footprint will one service riser, for example, cover. In instances like that, you may be working with a professional engineer, an architecture firm, but I think at the end of the day, it always comes back to having a professional, knowledgeable radon person involved in the overall design process.
Okay, we have a couple of different questions that have come up and wanting to know why the, in terms of, why is there a double requirement for licensing and certification when some licensing programs seem to have equal or superior to the certification programs, and just a maybe an answer on why HUD went with the dual roles and the national perspective.
Sure. So basically the reason that we decided to require a national standard as well as a state standard, first we required the state standard for licensing and certification because as a part of that state's activities that would be required anyway. We wanted to make sure that our staff looked for that within the documentation for those projects. And we also required a national program so that we would have, you know, as a national organization, it's in HUD's interest to have a national standard that can be relied upon for all of our deals. And that is basically the reason why we went with that.
And I think this is a the next question is more of a generic question relating to radon risk, and perhaps Sean, you might like to respond to it. But it, the question is basically, how do we respond to people who say there is no smoking gun with an autopsy? I assume that that relates to, or that question is serious, and that it's relating to how do we prove that radon is real? And
yeah, that's the age old question that we deal with a lot, and there is no perfect answer. You know, I usually boil it down to look at the health experts, look at the studies, look at the fact that you know, all of the government health organizations and a lot of the private ones understand that radiation is a very dangerous substance. And what I always come back with is when they find a study that shows that alpha particle strikes inside the human lung is actually healthy, then they can engage me in that conversation further. But as with any you know, with anything that we deal with in America today, there's people that believe and there's people that don't believe, and we could take that on any subject. You know, are seatbelts good? Well, some people think that it confines them. Some people think that it saves lives. So all we can do is put out the facts, the figures, but we're not going to change somebody's mind that truly doesn't have an open mind. So that's a good question. I wish that there was a perfect answer, and I don't know if anybody else on here has any better thought than that. But that's, you know, where I boil it down to. Where's the documentation? Where's the study that says alpha strikes inside the body are healthy?
Okay, I think we've got a few more minutes for questions. We will get to all of the questions, but I want to try to get a representative sample here. And here's a good question. Maybe perhaps Kyle might have some thoughts on it. Some all concrete structures have elevated levels, 10 to 20 picocuries from the concrete. It builds up because some have little ventilation. I wish this standard tested some upper floors, not just the ground floor units. Well, I think the you know, one of the key things that we've seen in this is that these are minimum recommendations from HUD, that they're a minimum, and that we're encouraging radon professionals to explain and communicate clearly to property managers and lenders, both on a health risk management and a risk management basis, that there is a reason for the standard and that upper floors should be tested, and that more than 25% it is a minimum beginning place. And certainly we've seen in some locales that condition where upper structures have higher levels. Kyle, do you have anything to say about that?
I think we hit on that in the presentation, in that, you know, specifically, you know, some areas of the country, Southeast, for example, you do have emanation that's been identified in building materials in upper levels of these areas. And the HUD standard is, or the HUD policy is, a minimum recommendation. So by embracing the multifamily measurement standard, you are, in fact, incorporating that 1 per level or 10%. And as Sean said, you'd want to stagger that back and forth so that you are getting a good sample to identify that that type of emanation from building materials.
Okay.
Actually, I do see a question here that came up in the little question box,
mm-hmm.
Asking what MAP and TAP means. And I apologize for not clarifying that during the presentation. I'm used to talking to our HUD employees who are super familiar with what those mean. And MAP is basically an accelerated processing option for people who are applying for HUD insurance through the multifamily program. TAP is the non-accelerated version, the traditional processing route. So there are two different ways of applying for multifamily insurance.
Great, great. And I don't know if you can see any other questions, Hillary, but if there's anything there that you want to get in the last few minutes, I've got maybe two more questions to throw out, and then, again, if we've missed your question, we will make sure we answer it. I have one under mitigation requirements. Please define building. Perhaps that again is, you know, we're used to knowing what we're talking about for multifamily buildings, but what does this rule particularly apply to? Maybe the size of the building.
Okay, I'm not quite sure what the question is, but I'll take it in two different ways and see if that answers it. What I think it may mean is when we say mitigation needs to be for the building, what do we mean? I mean that as opposed to unit by unit mitigation. The other way that I think this question may be meant is what kinds of buildings does this apply to, or, you know, what policy, what kind of buildings would this policy apply to? The policy is applied to multifamily buildings that apply for insurance under the multifamily office in the Office of Housing at HUD. And in general, multifamily buildings are defined to mean five or more units.
So I have one scientific question that we're going to ask Sean to step in and answer. And that is, do radioactive substances creating radon have a realistic half-life, and will they ever dissipate from a site? Maybe you could just give a short description of what radon's half-life, where it comes from, and why, what that process is, and why it's problematic and perhaps dissipating from a site over the next 10 to 20 years.
Sure. The answer is yes, it will go away. The answer to when is probably going to be in a few hundred billion years. The radon, of course, has a short half-life of 3.8 days, meaning if you contain just the radon gas over the course of about a month, it's pretty much all gone. The problem is radon is being created by radium. Radium is a metal that is in the concrete material potentially, and it's in the dirt, and it's spread all over the earth to some higher or lower concentrations. Its half-life is about 1,600 years. So, if you contained brand new radium, it's going to be creating radon for many thousands of years. It takes about 10 half-lives before something fully disintegrates down into nothing. The problem, though, is what creates radium. If you back it all the way back to uranium, and there are several other radioactive minerals that are in between uranium and radium, you're looking at things with millions of year half-lives. So the problem is it's in the earth. It's locked in the earth. We're mining it for building materials. Some places that's creating a problem, some places it's not. But then the buildings pulling the soil gas directly in right out of the earth itself, the radon problem is going to be around well past any of us. Thank you, Sean. And I'd like to thank all of the panelists for attending today. We do have a number of questions that are very good questions, and we will be answering them and making sure you all get these answers. One of the last or several questions have come up, and yes, it is a requirement that if you are
in a licensed state, you have to also be certified by NRPP or NRSB. And states and those certifying organizations have listings of licensed and certified professionals, or the licensing programs and certification organizations do. We will be posting this information. There will be FAQs up on the website. We will go into some more detail. I would like to thank all of the attendees who submitted questions, and I apologize for running out of time. And we're just beginning this process, of course. Implementation is an ongoing thing, and we're working hard to make sure that the definitions are out there and that we continue communicating with all stakeholders. So thank you, panelists, and thank you, everyone. Go to www.ars.org for the latest postings, and we will also be posting this on various professional listservs, and we'll be sending a notice to all of the attendees today on how to access this information. And I'd like to thank the staff at CADMIS and EPA for assisting us today. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating. This does conclude today's conference call. You may now disconnect.